So we're going to start the whip sessions right now. We have 18 whips to go through to get a breath of the exciting work that's going on right now. Each speaker is going to have 5 minutes in total, so they're supposed to stop about 4 minutes. I'll stand up about 4 minutes. Then if they end at that point, they'll have one or two questions that they can answer, and we'll immediately start the next talk 5 minutes, by that 5 minute later. And so we'll get through all 18 of these in an hour and a half or 90 minutes. And let's go ahead and begin with Jim Plank.
All right. Well, with 5 minutes, I don't have enough time for chit-chat. So we can all agree on many things in life that are evil, like, uh-oh. There we go. Like drugs and cancer and gun crime, what I want to do today is to add MTTDL to this list. Now, MTTDL is mean time to data loss, and much like bacon double cheeseburger, it's a very descriptive name. What it is if you have a disk system and you omnisciently know when it's going to fail, and then you have a whole bunch of disk systems and you know when they're going to fail, you can average all those times up and come up with a single number, which is the mean time to data loss. It's when your system can be expected to go down. Now, why do we like this metric? Well, we like it because it's a nice single number. It's very easy to generate with simulations or, if you're mathematically inclined but don't care about reality, Markov models. And the values are usually comfortingly large, 25 years, 50 years, 1,000 years. I feel safe. Unfortunately, I also believe it's meaningless. Now, it has a lot of bad things about it, and I should say I'm not the first person to point these things out. One is it's sensitive to parameters that are very hard to get, very hard to quantify reliably. And if you think about, instead of predicting the future, think about the past. What was my storage like 100 years ago? Don't really know. But these aren't the important reasons. The real reason is we just don't plain care about it. One, we can't compare these numbers. We have two systems, one that's going to fail on average in 50 years and another in 100. Can we compare those numbers? Moreover, they don't really give any precise quantification of what's the danger to my data now. So to be unrealistic, let's behold the exponential. If I have a system that's MTTDL is 100 years and I look at it as an exponential, what's my probability that I'm going to have data loss this year? 1%. Is that comfortingly small? So just to bring up a couple potential metrics to think about, I've scoured the literature. One is the bit half-life, which is the time after which the probability of a single bit failing is 50%. And the pros of this one is it's got a catchy name. But the cons of it is I don't really understand it. And if you look at it, it really looks like it's the median time to data loss scaled down to a bit rather than the mean time to data loss. So we'll look at a different one, which comes from a paper from Elrath, and that's the number of failures per 1,000 RAID groups. And there's no time in there. The time is a parameter of this. It's a nice metric in that it measures what you want, but it's got some cons in that there's a little bit too much data and it doesn't extrapolate in size very well. Plus, it doesn't have a catchy name. And finally, we have another one. It's called data loss events per petabyte year. Came from folks at IBM. I like this metric because it gets time, capacity, and catastrophe all within one single metric. And it's got the immediate danger to your data in there. The cons are it kind of implies that things scale linearly, which they really don't. Plus, it's got an uncatchy name. Now, I can try to help that. I guess DLEPI kind of does okay. But the one I like, we got DeLoPi. And if you think of DeLoPi, it's like JLoPi. But you just substitute the J with a day. So I have a quick example. Hakeem's standing up, so I might not go through it, of a simulation that we did, taking all these metrics and putting them in place. And what I like about this is rather than this 11-year mean time to data loss, which doesn't really have much meaning to me, the day low pi of 0.5% leads me to believe if I were spending money on this system and my data meant something to me, I'd be doing something better for reliability. So just to conclude all of this, please stop sending me these papers with mean time to data loss calculations. It's the one thing I want you to get out of this talk.
Great, thank you. We have time for one question. Does anybody have a question?
I want to give you one more, and I think it's a lot simpler. Just bits lost per year. Nothing more.
Blip. Okay.
Okay. Hello. My name is Tudor Dimitris, and today I will present our work in progress on upgrades as a service and distributed systems. This is joint work with my advisor, Professor Priya Narasimhan from Carnegie Mellon University. Now, traditionally, fault tolerance approaches focus on tolerating unexpected faults or security violations. But nowadays, downtime is usually due to scheduled events such as software upgrades. So we looked at the upgrade history of Wikipedia in order to determine what are the main reasons for planned downtime. Why do people do these upgrades offline? And the main reason turns out to be incompatible database schema changes. So basically, whenever you do sufficient changes to your database schema, your old version of the middle tier is no longer able to query the new version of the data, so the upgrade they have to be upgraded together. If we look at all the 55 possible upgrades among the first 11 versions of Wikipedia, 50 out of these would require planned downtime, and only 5 of those can be done online. And essentially, whenever we want to do an online upgrade with existing techniques, we have to gradually move from the old version to the new version. And this requires having two versions coexist in the production system. They have to respond to the live workload and have to synchronize their states in the back end. So this is the reason why we have planned downtime. And to give you an example, one of these squares represents the upgrade between version 1.4 to version 1.5, which was done in 2004 by Wikipedia and which required 22 hours of downtime. So in order to address this problem, we propose a new approach, which is based on a very simple idea. So we want to isolate the production system from the upgrade operations. And we achieve this by installing the new version on what we call a parallel universe, which is realized either through separate hardware or through a virtualized infrastructure. And then we transfer the data from the old version to the new one. So the isolation between the two parallel universes allows us to avoid upgrade failures. And the fact that the new version does not have to be in a consistent state until the end of the upgrade allows us to avoid planned downtime. Now, as you can see, the main disadvantage of this approach is that we require additional resources, twice the amount of storage, twice the amount of hardware. But these additional resources are only needed during the upgrade for implementing and for testing the upgrade. So therefore, we can lease them from existing cloud computing infrastructures such as the Amazon Web Services. So what this essentially achieves is a separation of concerns between the functional aspects of the upgrade, which are things such as the schema conversions that I talked about, and the mechanisms for performing an online upgrade, such as implementing an atomic switchover from the old version to the new one. So if we look at our code base, between 14 and 22% is dedicated to code that is specific to the application. So these are the functional, this corresponds to the functional aspects, the state transfer, and the rest of the code is generic and can be reused for upgrading different applications. And one case study that we have in one use case for this approach would be to support a migration into from a physical infrastructure to a virtualized infrastructure, which is a common concern in the industry nowadays. Thank you.
Do we have a question or two? So just a little bit on the procedure. We're going on the same order so people can follow along. So same order as the website. Our next person is Richard Spillane, and the next person after that will be Ben Fan. So if you're here, come up. And then Milo Polt is next on deck after that.
This is preview, not a double. Hi, I'm Rick Spillane. I'm from Stonebrook University. Today I'm going to tell you a little bit about our ongoing research at the File Systems and Storage Lab on modularizing the VFS out of the kernel and why we have to do that and why we want to do that. So if you were to look at a standard implementation for a storage server on a single node today, clients are going to talk to a message service, which is then going to forward their requests to a server cache. The server cache is then going to get dirtied or hit, and misses and writebacks will go to the storage hardware. If you want that to go faster, you're going to remove the message service, and you're going to basically just have the clients directly access the server cache by just mapping it in their virtual address space and doing the traversals and hits and misses themselves. And that's great, except it's unsafe. So to make it safe, we're going to use a memory protection unit and privilege escalation, de-escalation, and trapping. So problem is if you were to look at what the VFS is today, it basically is what it is. Clients are accessing the VFS because the VFS does something that all the file systems want. It does inode and de-entry caching. It does virtual to physical file map caching and other useful little things like that. And so it's a great reuse of code, and it's wonderful. The problem is if you want to do something else, you're kind of screwed. So what you would have to do is you have to implement a user-level server cache. You're going to have to re-implement many of the aspects of page caching already handled by the kernel. You're going to have a lot of back-and-forth talk with the kernel. And unless you do something about it, it's going to be insecure because all the processes can access that shared memory and do whatever they want to each other. So just sort of as a practical hack to fix first-order problems, we're going to introduce a new security level between the user privilege level and the kernel privilege level by using one of the unused rings in the CPU. And we're actually going to introduce a new system call that lets you trap in the kernel and then trap back into a privilege shared library. So this should remind you of some things that were happening in the early 80s and then later in the early 90s. Once you're in that privilege shared library, you can execute whatever you want. Your thread is going to have its own stack, and you can just go, you know, crazy. To reduce message passing, we're going to extend the MMAP interface. This is also going to let most servers' privileged libraries reuse the page cache implementation already present in the kernel. We've extended MMAP to support page pinning, disk cache flushing, and when there's memory pressure, the kernel will send a signal to the server cache telling it to release memory, otherwise face swapping and future thrashing. So we've taken the initiative, we've implemented this, we've tested it, it's great. We've actually re-implemented most aspects of the VFS in C++ as a server cache in user space. We do our own path name lookup, our own de-entry inode caching, the works. And we found that basically there's almost no overhead. We're the pink guys, EXPPC, and this is for a pretty intense in-cache workload where context switching is going to hurt a lot and where there's almost no I.O. involved. So Fuse is falling by the wayside, because they're doing a lot of context switching and memory copies. Hook, which is the green guy, shows you basically the cost of just trapping, assuming that we don't do the VFS in user space, but just basically use our service to trap back into the kernel. What do we want to do next? Well, we want to take a current architecture and generalize it, so instead of having just us be a privileged library, we want to let anybody be a privileged library. We want to extend MMAP to let you do all kinds of crazy new things with it that most people might want to do as a privileged library. Maybe you want to have a shared memory database cache because you want to do an object store and you hate POSIX API, so you can do that now. And you can compete with the VFS for in-cache performance. Next, we want to remove the VFS from the kernel, like that. And we basically want to go into the kernel source tree and delete the VFS code and make it be a new user-level service because at least our initial results show that the performance would still be there and architecturally it would be a lot simpler. So what does this give you? Why would we want to do this? Specialized caching is the answer. We can purpose-build the cache to the workload. Also, we can do things that the mainstream people don't like transactions, provenance, restarts, distribution, memory checking, whatever. Finally, there's a lot of systems that you have to start from scratch, whether you like it or not, and this would be a great framework for those people to start from. The second reason is we want a reconfigurable VFS. So basically, we firmly believe one size not fit all. File systems aren't going to go away. There's always going to be need to refer to locally stored and controlled large-ish objects. And otherwise, hard links and directories could go out the window tomorrow. We'd like to support different types of naming models, hierarchical or non, like perspective distributing. And we think modularity is a good thing. So basically, one size not fit all. User level can be kernel fast. And we believe our approach is the right direction. I can take your questions now. I'm Rick. These are the relevant links, and we'd love to collaborate if you guys, anybody out there, wants to. Thank you.
Okay, if no questions, and next we're going to Lin Zhao, who's going to talk about disreduce raiding the cloud.
Hi, I'm going to talk about this project, disreduce raiding the cloud. Oops. Okay, here it is. So disreduce raiding the cloud. This is a joint work with my colleagues, Binfan Whitwood, and my advisor, Garth Gibson. So people love cloud computing, and Hadoop file system is one popular storage system in this cloud computing infrastructure. So similar to Google file system, it also triplicates data. We are considering about why not using read to lower this 200% storage overhead lower. One possible reasons from developers is about the concerns of complexity. Oh, I'll just keep. Sorry about that. Okay. So one major concern is about the complexity by doing reads in this Hadoop file system. So what we want to do in this project is to find one simple solution to bring this read into the cloud. How we are going to do this? We are using asynchronous encoding. So there is no change in the client code. You still triplicate data first. And we use the background process to do this encoding work. There's already exists one background process in the HDFS to do the repair work. So we decouple this writing data and encoding to make solution simple. And by doing this asynchronous encoding, we can also get some benefits. One possible benefit is by delaying encoding to idle time, we can hide the encoding cost. The other one is we can benefit some reads. As you can see from this graph, based on the traces from Yahoo M45 cluster, if with one day delay, we can serve 80% of the reads with three data copies. And here is how we implement this encoding and reconstruction. So for encoding, metadata server keeps track of which data blocks should be grouped together, and it assigns this work to the data server. So with good data placement policy, all the encoding work can be done locally without any network transfer. So for reconstruction, the metadata server will keep track of which data blocks should be repaired and assign the work to data servers. As you can see from these two figures, there is no client-side involved. So we are trying to say that the code is simple. And we implement this one with HDFS 20.0. This graph shows writing 1 terabyte data with 40 nodes. And the bottom line is the user data. The purple line is the data with the data in ideal RAID 6. The x-axis shows the time in seconds, and the y-axis shows the space in terabytes. This blue line shows generating data with triplication. And after data are generated, we wait for a while and start encoding. As you can see that after the encoding, it can almost reach the ideal storage overhead. But the encoding work is sort of expensive. That's also the reason why we want to delay this encoding work to idle time so that you can't see this cost. Since we are going to delay encoding, we are going to keep data which are triplicated for a while. And people believe that for data with triplication, there are some benefits. And we can see this benefits as a cache. So basically, there are two different types of data in our disk. One is the triplicated data, and the other one is read encoded data. We can use cache replacement policies to decide what to encode when the space when we reach some threshold for the space. Basically, these are how we implement this reduce for now, and we can bring about like 3 times space for users, and with this asynchronous encoding, you can see that we can hide the encoding cost, and we can also benefit some reads. Any questions?
Next, we have Milo Polt, and he's going to talk to us about enabling scientific application I.O. on cloud-based file systems.
Hi, I'm Milo, and this is joint work I've done with Esteban from UC Santa Cruz and a lot of other people at other places I don't have time to go through. So we all know supercomputers are getting powerful and larger day by day. The current winner is Jaguar from Oak Ridge National Labs, which according to the top500.org gets about 1.75 petaflops of computing cycles. But the biggest and largest general-purpose computing clusters out there are no longer these giant supercomputers. They're these large cloud machines, these large cloud clusters. So here's a picture from 2006 New York Times of a large facility Google built in Oregon. At the time, the New York Times estimated that Google had approximately 450,000 machines across all their sites, which was estimated at being around 20 to 100 petabytes. So that's 4 years ago, and this is the biggest supercomputer now. So there's all these massive cycles out there, computational resources, that we would like to be able to leverage our important apps on. What type of apps am I talking about? I'm talking about these sacred scientific apps, huge parallel programs like climate simulations, astrophysics, cybersecurity models. These things are large, they're parallel, and a large amount of time and expense has been put into verifying them and debugging them. So no one wants to go in to make changes, because if you do, you're going to introduce new bugs. Consider them untouchable. And on their I.O. path, these generally assume a POSIX file system or an MPI I.O. interface that allows them to have concurrent writers accessing a single file at once. But herein lies a mismatch between these assumptions and what a cloud file system typically assumes. So for example, HDFS only allows you to have one writer per open file at a time, doesn't allow concurrent writes, doesn't allow you to open up a file later and rewrite it. So our goal is to take these important apps and run them unmodified on top of cloud file systems. And our approach to doing so is going to be a creation of this fuse-based interposition layer. And I'm going to run you through the design at a high level right now. So here I have a picture of an underlying cloud file system storage and 3 nodes on top with 2 processors each and a certain amount of data they want to put into the system. We create an interposition layer in between the app and the actual storage. And as far as the applications are concerned, they simply write to this layer normally. They all open a file, they see a POSIX interface, they write to it, and it absorbs the writes. Under the hood, our interposition layer is setting up a container, a subdirectory within the cloud file system with 1 data log per writer. And these actual writes that are going by are not going to a single file, but each one of them has exclusive access to their individual data files. This is an adaptation of a work that we did previously called the parallel log structured file system, designed to improve the performance of parallel file systems, here used to increase the semantics of a cloud file system. So in summary, it's an interposition layer that lets us use our cloud file system storage for our scientific apps. It's going to permit us to increase the semantics to permit things like reopen concurrent writers. And its main operation is by decoupling the shared writes to a single file into exclusive writes to individual data files, then aggregating those back on the reads. There's no change to the underlying cloud file system or the applications in this approach. So we've started writing it, we have plans on how to test it, and I research questions going forward. And if you have any questions about this, you can ask me now or come talk to us at our poster later. Thank you.
Great. Next, we have Joel Coburn present non-volatile transactional memory.
Thanks, Hakeem. So I'm a member of the Non-Volatile Systems Lab at UC San Diego. And we're focusing on how new non-volatile memory technologies can be integrated into systems, how we want to think about storage, and how we should go about programming them. So today our focus is on a new abstraction we've been designing called non-volatile transactional memory. And the way we kind of got to that point was to look at existing systems, and we said, okay, well, we know we always have volatile memory, DRAM. We have non-volatile memory in the form of disk. Disk is, you know, many orders of magnitude slower than DRAM, so the cost of going to storage is huge. But at the same time, there are new non-volatile memory technologies that are going to be fast and byte addressable. And so technologies like phase change memory, spin torque transfer memory, and others are going to sit on the main memory bus alongside DRAM. They're going to have performance comparable to DRAM, you know, through effective wear leveling. They'll have adequate lifetimes. And so now, really, I/O will be accessible in nanoseconds, potentially. And so this is a huge advantage. But we'll kind of give up all of this performance if we use the existing abstraction that we have. And so what we currently have is we always go through the operating system to access disk, right? Even if the data is in the file buffer cache, we still have to pay this performance penalty of performing a systems call and going through the file system. And so to show you how that's a problem with these new technologies, I did a really simple experiment of just a random read from a large file. And what I'm showing here is the latency components. And so for a disk, the green bar, the overhead of the disk itself, totally dominates that. For an SSD, it also dominates. But then if you look at fast non-volatile memories, you can't even really see that green bar anymore that corresponds to the hardware overhead. And instead, that overhead's entirely due to going through the operating system. And so if we use the existing system stack, we leave 100x performance on the table. So to redesign the system stack, we wanted to achieve a few important goals. One is that it be fast. We want the application to see latency roughly equal to the latency of storage itself. And if it's sitting on the same bus as DRAM, we should be able to access it with loads and stores. At the same time, if we're going to use it as storage, we'd like to have it be, you know, we'd like to have persistence and reliability. We'd want to be able to build data structures that would be robust against failures. And then at the same time, we'd want it to be very flexible. We'd want to be able to build, you know, interesting data structures directly in non-volatile memory and have them exist across runs of a program or power cycles of a machine. And so, you know, pointers would be meaningful across runs of a program and things like that. So our abstraction is non-volatile transactional memory. So we redesigned the system stack so that now the application can go directly to non-volatile memory. We provide persistence and consistency with a transactional memory layer. And we provide flexibility by exposing a non-volatile heap abstraction to the application. And then we can still go through the operating system for, you know, sort of the more administrative tasks of, you know, allocation, mapping, and protection. And that's okay because these operations are less frequent. So we performed some initial experiments, and what I've done is compared our system to a transactional storage library called Stasis. And so on the y-axis, we have speed up on a log scale compared to Stasis. The blue bar is Stasis running on disk, so that's normalized at 1. The red bar is Stasis running on a RAM disk, so that represents, you know, using the same abstraction but going to DRAM instead of disk. And then the green bar represents MVTM running in DRAM, so it's changing the abstraction. And so we're 1,000 times better than Stasis running on RAM disk and 10,000 times better than it running on disk. So I think non-volatile transactional memory is a good first abstraction for kind of matching the performance characteristics of these new memories with a very natural and easy way to program persistent data structures. Thanks.
Great. Okay, thank you. All right, great. Now we have Osama Khan and Randall Burns talking about verifying massively data parallel multi-stage computations.
Hi, I'm Osama, and I'm going to talk about, so this is some work which I'm doing with Randall Burns. It's about verifying large-scale data parallel computations. Okay, So as all of you know, there's this recent trend of parallelizing various computing constructs, ranging from processors to disks, data structures and algorithms, and so on and so forth. Platforms like Dryad and MapReduce have allowed us to build parallel programs working on large data sets by hiding a lot of the infrastructure details based on their platform, and that makes it a very attractive proposition to developers nowadays. But the problem is that hiding the infrastructure detail actually consists of remote untrusted machines, which may or may not be malicious, or as one of the earlier talks mentioned, may have hardware malfunctions in the form of bit flips. So there's definitely a need for assurance in the correctness of these computations. So before we actually delve on the problem of verification itself, we actually wanted to define a generalized model which could define these computations. We use a graph-based model, which is similar to the one used by Dryad. In that model, the vertices denote sequential code blocks, which adhere to the functional programming paradigm, and the edges denote data paths in the system. So in order to keep our verification mechanism as adaptable as possible, we do not restrict the message format or assume any a priori knowledge of the computation itself. We use composite data commitments to allow efficient verification, and we rely on random sampling, which naturally lends itself to outputting probabilistic guarantees. So let's look at a very small example. We've got a simple graph, three stages. The red M's, I hope you can see it, denote the messages. The blue small deltas denote the individual commitments, which are just the hash of the messages. And the green big deltas denote the composite commitments, which is essentially the root of the Merkle hash tree over the individual blue hashes. So stage I minus one has been completed, and we're going to run through the execution and verification of stage I. So essentially start off with the nodes in stage I, solicit input from the previous stage, which is these M's. It calculates the composite input commitment, which is the root of a Merkle hash tree over the input messages. It uses the input data to calculate the output and the corresponding individual hash values of those output messages. And it also computes the composite output commitment, which is, again, the root of a Merkle hash tree with the individual blue small delta hash values as the leaves. So as you can see, on both the input and output side, we have a composite commitment value. So right now, the execution of stage I has completed, and now we need to verify it. That happens by, first of all the compute nodes have to send signed versions of their input and output composite commitments to an auditor. An auditor is a trusted entity in the system. So the auditor then randomly chooses a subset of nodes in that stage. For this example, simple example, the auditor chose D to be sampled. So it asks for the input data to D from the compute node. It gets the data back. It hashes the data and arrives at its own version of the individual commitments for the two data sets. And then it asks for proof of membership from the compute nodes, which are witnesses in a Merkle hash tree. And then it uses that proof of membership to verify two values, the lambda, which is the composite input commitment, and the two composite output commitments from the previous stage. So these are two verifications happening, essentially. We're verifying lambda, and lambda is used to actually verify that this is the data, so we have got the data which the node has used to compute the output. And the deltas are essentially saying that the data which was used to calculate, which was used by D in this stage, actually was the data which was produced in the output of the previous stage. So that's linking back to the previous stage. And we use this link back feature all the way through. So the input is verified, and now the output can be verified simply by redundantly running the function D again. We had the inputs, so we can just run FD on that and get the outputs. We generate the individual commitments again and verify that what we got matches with the signed versions. Obviously you can say that the actual guarantee, the level of assurance you will get, will depend greatly on the actual sampling and corruption strategies employed. But I mean, that's a detail which I'll be happy to go into later in the poster session, I guess. But on an ending note, I can say that for some typical parameters used in such a system, we can achieve 99% probability of detection of an error in computation with only 5% redundancy overhead. And I guess for the details, I can either take questions now or I can discuss this at the poster session. Thank you.
In general, we do have time for one question. If somebody does want to come to the mic. All right, next we have Lei Zhu with HiFire.
Hello, everyone. This is Lei Zhu from University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Today, I'm going to talk about high-fidelity trace replayer for large-scale storage systems. Accurately trace replaying plays a critical role in the research and development process of new storage and file systems. But now those new large-scale storage systems require new technicals to achieve high-fidelity replaying results. For example, those new storage systems introduce the new APIs like REST or SOAP for Amazon S3, or Hadoop DFS API. Most of them have file-level semantics. Meanwhile, those storage systems require parallel trace replayer facilities. For example, how do we simulate data transfer or MapReduce task in the Hadoop environment? Those conventional approach include like batteries from FastO4. They have a complex scheduler, which is not scalable, and the ReplayFS from FastO5, it requires kernel mode modification, but which makes it not portable. And the parallel trace from FastO7, it can issue the parallel events, but it has performance issues. Thus, we argue that for good storage benchmark tool, it has four requirements: high fidelity, scalability, performance, and portability. Thus, we design HiFile in an attempt to meet those requirements. Now let's see the architecture for HiFile. HiFile can take different types of source as input and issue the IOs to different types of device or storage systems. There are two major components for it. The first one is scheduler, which it tries to fully utilize the hardware to generate heavy load requests in time. And the other one is I/O device layer, which provide a unified I/O interface for the scheduler and hide the difference between the raw device to the storage system like cloud or cluster storage. It also support block level and file level trace. The current status, we implement a prototype of a HiFile on a Linux server, which written by 1,500 lines of C++ code and running in user mode process. We feed it with a Finance One trace from UMass and Exchange server trace from the Microsoft. This is the result from for the Finance One trace. The left one is the IOPS for Finance One trace, and the right one is about the error time for each IOs. From the Finance One trace result, we can assume that 96% of IOs were issued within 10 microseconds, and 80% of IOs were issued within 1 microsecond. And we intensified Exchange server trace by a factor of 10, then we can achieve a maximum IOPS of 13,000. 81% of IOs were issued within 10 microseconds, and 89% of IOs were issued within 15 microseconds. Compared to the Batrix, which issued about 92% of IOs within 80 microseconds in loads, much lighter than the intensive load of a HiFile, we claim that HiFile can generate more accurate results under similar loads. The future work, we plan to extend current HiFile to support large-scale systems like cluster storage system, for example, Hadoop DFS, or cloud storage system like Amazon S3. And we try to fully explore the processing parallelism of multi-core processors by incorporating with the multi-kernel ideas. And we will add feedback control to regenerate workloads by analyzing previous runs and support FS. File system image and aging. We will also support more trace formats and workload generator in the future. Finally, we will open source our HiFile for the research community and the industry. If you have any questions, please see me in the post session. Thank you very much.
Great. Next, we have Adam Manzanares.
It's Manzanares.
Manzanares.
Thank you. So I'm going to talk about the energy efficient striping within our energy aware virtual file system. And I'm from Auburn University, and my advisor is Dr. Zhao Chun. Okay, so first off, basically, I'll talk about what our energy aware virtual file system, the high level view of what it does. So it manages the locations for all the files, and it's kind of this distributed file system. And I have an overview of the architecture in the next slide, and I'll go over that a little bit more. And so it actually load balances among all the nodes inside of the distributed file system, and it can also load balance within each storage node, and I'll explain what the storage nodes are in a little further. And so each storage node manages the disk states, and it allows the clients to access all the data within the file system. So here's a high-level overview of kind of what happens here. And so we have these server nodes right now. And so what it does is it's in charge of distributing data across all these storage nodes. And within each storage node, we have any number of disks. And in this case, I just have 3 disks here. And we're going to have 1 disk as a buffer disk where we can store popular data where we want to access that data first off. And so but we kind of have this tiered approach here where the server, he just gives data locations to each storage node, but it doesn't really matter. He's not concerned with the actual disk that the data is on. And so the storage nodes themselves will take the file and then decide which data disk to put it on and whether or not to buffer it. And so the storage nodes manage all the disk states. And I'll just give a little bit of background information. Is typically with energy efficient disk systems right now, you put the disk into the standby mode, which is a pretty time-consuming, and it can impact performance greatly, operation. So it's something that has to be managed carefully. And so these storage nodes are the ones that do that, and the server has no concern about that. So, okay. So why did this work go into energy-aware virtual file system? So we started doing this work with kind of looking at block-level prefetching, but as we started with models and simulation, and then I wanted to move in towards implementation, and so the thing with block-level prefetching, it's pretty difficult because you don't really know what the data is being used for and different things like that. So what I found out is that you had to kind of look at the file system level. And so the file system's a natural place to track these file accesses. Can you see which data is being used at what time and how often it's being used and so forth and so on? It's a place where you could track that information. And so you can control the placement also with this distributed energy-aware virtual file system. You control the placement of where the files go within each storage node, and then within the storage node, which disk it goes on. And so this tiered approach kind of helps simplify the management of files and disk states, and it allows it to grow at a quicker pace. So here's basically how these energy-efficient striping groups work. So within here, so when we take a group, we're going to group storage nodes into groups. So we'll take storage node 1, storage node 2, and make that in a group. So if a file comes in, the server node will decide which group to send the file to. And so file 1 will go to group 1, and file 2 goes to group 2. And only the server knows what the groups are. They're not really aware of that themselves, whether they're the group or not. So that's how the files get split up within here. And so files 3 and 4 go to group 1 and group 2, so on. So, but within each group, we're going to stripe the files. So if file 1 comes in for group 1, it's going to be split into two pieces across the two different storage nodes across the different disks. And file 2 will come into disk 2 and disk 4, and it'll be on the other disk in the storage node. And then all the other files kind of come in, and then the popular data gets put into the buffer disk with the same striping level so that the buffer disks are still able to maintain some performance. And so why we do this is we want to, the number of disks in a group can be matched to like the closest bottleneck, whether it's with a network interface and different things like that. And striping within the group helps maintain relatively high performance, and it allows us to use a buffer disk in each storage node while still maintaining the striping level. And so right now we have a prototype completed, and we have some experimental results. And within a storage node, we've measured up to 12.5% energy savings in a storage node. And so we're going to have to extend this prototype. And what we've been looking at is implementing some of these ideas in PVFS. And we need to run it in a large-scale environment because we currently don't have a very large-scale environment. So that's for the future work. And if there's any questions, I also have a poster, so you can come see me and talk to me about that. So thank you.
Great. Next is Luke McNeese.
All right. Well, my name is Luke McNeese, and I'm from Tennessee Technological University with the STAR Lab. And this is the work on the hot page associative translation layer for solid-state drives is work in conjunction with Guangying Wu and Zhu Minhe. So the motivation behind the HPAT system is that solid-state drives require FTLs, or flash translation layers, to handle translation. And then so we can use the mapping unit that has a direct effect on the performance of the FTL. So there's basically two different types of mapping schemes. You have your page-level mapping schemes, which write the new data anywhere, and then they require a large amount of disk space. But and the reverse side of that is the block-level mapping, which is also referred to as a log-and-merge system. And this consumes a high amount of log blocks, which are kind of like a scratch or like a buffer block. And the results, these results in many full merges during garbage collections. And then so some of the issues with the existing FTLs are the log block consumption and the full merge cost. And I have listed examples of these issues. And they work very poorly on random hot workloads. And so that's what we're trying to get out of this. The fast consumes less but still has a many-to-one relationship. And the best has a low associativity degree, which is the number of blocks that are involved in a full merge, which causes the garbage collection to increase in time. And then so some of the observations that we have seen so far is for a disk write workload, overwrites dominate, as stated in the Griffin paper for with HDDs as a cache for STDs that was presented, that will be presented tomorrow. And then so hotspots are an uneven access. And so that as so for a small subset of the work set, that's where about 80% or, according to Griffin, over 90% of the writes occur on 20% of the blocks. And then so as we can see from this graph, the front part of the green and the blue lines show that a small subset of the pages and the blocks are going to be very hot. And then so this this shows that we need to treat these more differently than the sequential cold blocks. And also, we can find that hot pages exist in cold blocks, so we need to place them together to take better advantage of temporal and spatial locality. And then so we propose a new solution, the HPAT. The hot page is the associative translation layer. And so that we need to treat these the pages differently and separate the hot and cold pages of random writes, and then use the best mapping and logging schemes, which are best for the locality for the writes. And the translation will result in a very low associativity degree, which is, like I said, the number of blocks involved with the merge, which is the biggest drawback, the biggest time consumption in garbage collection. And this will only have a minimal increase in the mapping table size. And then so this is a diagram of the HPAT architecture. So we have the incoming write request. It comes into the workload dispatcher, which is where HPAT will sit, and then it will decide where each of the random writes, and also decide whether the writes are going to be hot or cold. and then it'll go through a wear level leveler, which will ensure that the SSD is weared through evenly throughout the entire disk. And so an example workload, and this workload is for a hot random writes, the BAST will have a many-to-many relationships from log blocks to data blocks, which will cause a high associativity degree, which will do an increased time in garbage collection. And the FAST will have a one-to-many relationship, which will still have a not as high, but still high associativity degree. And HPAT has a one-to-one relationship for the random hot blocks. And then so the status and future work of HPAT is that we're in algorithm development and workload analysis. And our future work will contain a refinement of the algorithm and validating the proposed FTL through FlashSim. Thank you.
Great, so now we have Aletha Parker-Wood talking about security aware partitioning for fast file system search.
Hi, I'm Aletha. I'm from the University of California, Santa Cruz, and I'm going to be talking about security aware partitioning. So first, a brief introduction to partitioning. Partitioning is a system designed for indexing. It divides the file system into disjoint pieces called partitions, and each of these pieces has an index which is sized to fit fully into main memory. Filtering mechanisms such as Bloom filters and indirect indexes can be used to choose which partitions you're going to load into memory in order to search them. Several algorithms already exist for this. There's SmartStore, there's Spyglass. Why did we write another one? Introducing security-aware partitioning. As the old saw goes, if you do security after the fact, you might as well have not done it. So instead, we've chosen to build security right into the partitioning algorithm. In this instance, if someone can see a file in a partition, they can see every file in this partition. This prevents expensive filtering operations after the fact. So you can be assured that if any results are returned from a partition, you have permissions to see them, and you can quickly eliminate partitions that you don't have access to. Our partitioning criteria is based on POSIX-style file permissions. We assume that it will work similarly for ACLs. So, for instance, if we begin at the root in partition 1, we have an initial partition. If you add permissions, then this doesn't increase the number of people who could possibly get to that directory or file, so this doesn't create a new partition. However, if we move on to partition number 2, you'll notice that we have a new user and execute has been removed. This means that a different set of people will be able to see the files in here. So this generates a new partition. If we move on to partition 3, the user hasn't changed, but the group has. And again, this means a different set of users. And finally, in partition 4, we've changed the user and nothing else. And so this results in yet another set of partitions. In addition to this, we've built a new framework for evaluating partitioning. The conventional approach has been to synthesize queries based on some ad hoc set of criteria. Having synthesized them, you run them on the partitioning and you get statistics. This isn't a tremendously convincing approach simply because it doesn't mirror what people will do in the real world. Our approach instead is to generate a set of metrics for expected efficiency over all queries. So we're actually building mathematical models of what a query might look like and then examining how well we perform under any set of queries. In particular, we're looking at entropy. This is the intra-partition similarity. How dense are these? How similar is everything within this partition? We're looking at information gain, inter-partition similarity. How different are these different partitions? So if you're looking for one thing, how many of these will you need to look in? And finally, we look at partition size. If you generate a lot of small partitions, you may need to search many of them to find the files that you're looking for. That means a lot of disk accesses. That means loading a lot of things in. So an ideal algorithm will be one which generates a lot of large partitions, but not so large that they overflow the memory. We have a poster at the poster session. We also have evaluation numbers, and I'd love to talk to any of you. We'll now take questions.
Great. Next, we have Carlos Maltzan and InfoGarden.
Yeah, this is a project that I do together with Michael Matthias and Jim Whitehead, both members of the game design group at UC Santa Cruz. And this is an attempt to merge the work that we do in Santa Cruz with information management and storage systems with some of the gaming folks there. And 2 years ago, Kathy Marshall gave a great keynote. I don't know if here at this conference whether you saw it, but basically demonstrated the agonizing difficulties people have with their personal data collections. And so, and it's only getting worse. And so we decided to sort of attack this problem with maybe a gaming approach. One particular challenge is that people just don't have time or seem to have time to really do the work that is needed to actually do digital curation. So we came up with a hypothesis which we call the game reward hypothesis, and it's basically the idea is to recast archive maintenance as a game. So there are existing examples where games have been put to productive use. P.S. Doom was perhaps one of the first examples where Dennis Cao embedded the Unix tool PS into the Doom environment, a first-person shooter game, to basically kill processes. And the other one was the ESP game by Luis von Ahn, who's created actually a number of games with a purpose and had great success with them. So a very compelling evidence is that gaming might be a promising approach is that people actually spend a lot of time on games. The Casual Games Association had a report in 2007 showing that people on average spend 7 to 15 hours per week playing online casual games. And I should define casual games. Those are games that are, you know, anybody's playing, very simple rule set. Those are not hardcore games. So the hypothesis is a game approach significantly increases time users dedicate to archive maintenance. It's easy to measure. We just have to measure the time people spend on their archives. So here's the idea. InfoGarden. So we decided to focus on tagging, which is a common and tedious task if you look at your photo collection. So the idea is basically to compare a personal archive with a garden. And so on the left you see a neglected archive a garden version of that, and then to the right side you see a well-maintained garden. That's a well-maintained archive, right? So how do we get this mapping? So the semantics of our games are basically consisting of weeds, plants, fruits, and a crosshair that allows us to reveal the meaning of the individual vegetation. And so so basically, a weed is a document without a tag. It crops up on your laptop, you know, and it's pretty natural. A plant is a taxonomy of loosely, you know, somehow semantically coupled documents that have been tagged. A fruit is actually an association of a document with a taxonomy. So when you tag a document, you can actually have multiple fruits. Anyway, so the game area looks like this. You have on the bottom, you can enter tags that you can shoot onto the weeds. So you're shooting weeds with tags. It's actually quite satisfying to see that when you actually, I hope to present it during the poster session. And what you see, basically what you then do by shooting tags at weeds, you convert them into fruits that are getting attached to plants. And that's essentially what this picture is supposed to convey. It's a little complicated. But essentially, the word gets shot to the weed, and then you get a plant with a fruit that essentially shows the thing. So the similar thing is you can actually refine your tagging with existing fruits. You get various sound effects. I should say there's actually a scoring associated with this. You get basically 1 point for each shot weed, and then plus a number of fruits that you create. I'm seeing that we're running out of time. I'd like to have some time for questions, but see me at my poster. Thanks.
Great. Next, we have Tony Mason with Fuse for Windows.
So we were sitting around over the holiday break and saying, gosh, wouldn't it be nice to do something useful? And so we decided that we would see how hard it would be to put together a Fuse layer for Windows. What we actually do is help people build kernel-level technologies for Windows versus a lot of people I know who work on Linux. And my area of expertise and what I've been doing for the last 15 years is working on file systems technologies. We have a toolkit that we work with customers to build file systems. We've built file systems for the old Macintosh file system. We've done NFS implementations. We've done EXT2. We did a native implementation of that ourselves. And I forgot to list it, but in fact, Coda for Windows was done using our toolkit as well. So we said, okay, this is great, but these are all kernel level implementations. What can we do to actually make this work in user mode? So what we did was we took the kernel mode component that we have, the library, we built a service that communicates with the kernel mode library, and we said, great, let's start shipping everything up to user mode and see how it goes. So our goal really was to be able to take a Fuse file system, we took the Fuse example, and move it onto Windows and make it behave as much as possible like a native Microsoft-provided Windows file system. One of our goals here is to actually encourage people to play with Windows as well as playing with Linux. Because after all, if you can just take a Fuse file system and move it over, why not? There's still a couple of Windows systems left out there in the world. So we did it. It wasn't a whole lot of effort. Actually, most of the effort turned out to be trying to figure out SigWin and GCC, because for Windows people, that's a little different. But we did it. What we right now have is the sample ported, running on Windows. I've got a couple of screenshots in a moment. Very minimal modifications to the code base. The biggest thing that we didn't do is we didn't actually implement chown. We didn't implement the extended attributes callbacks. Just things that we haven't gotten around to, not because they're overly difficult, just because chown is a little hard because you have to map Unix-style semantics to Windows-style semantics when it comes to security. So there's a little bit of work that has to be done there. Very basic performance. We didn't do any performance work at all on this. We know that we'd have to do some in order to make this production quality. A basic copy of a 50 megabyte file on the particular system was about 5 seconds. Copying it onto the Fuse example file system was about 7 seconds. So what is that, about 40% slower. More detailed information about what we saw for a variety of things. These numbers are actually show a significant decrease. Open is a really bad example usually because that's very small operation sending up back and forth to user mode, so you get a lot of the overhead associated with the context switching. The read times were better but still not what I would call stellar at this point. Clearly there's work to do. But it does work. There you go. That's Notepad. Notepad is one of those examples that we normally use when people first start playing with file systems on Windows and say, this is going to get you. Because it uses the memory mapping interface, which is very common and standardly used by applications here. So this requires that you have full integration into the virtual memory system, and it's all there. It's just done. Basic directory listings were working, Explorer was working, those kinds of things. So this was a working example. We will be making this freely available for non-commercial use. I've been pushing people on and saying, okay, great, well, can I point people to a website where they can download it? That isn't quite done at this point, so my revenge is to put Dan's name up here and his email address. So if you're interested in this, send an email to him. He loves to hear from people. Thank you very much.
Okay, great. Next, we have Karthik discussing revisiting I/O middleware for the cloud.
Hey, in this presentation, we'll be looking at our ideas on revisiting the I/O middleware for the cloud based on cloud applications and their usage. with all the buzz about cloud computing, lots of companies and applications have been moving into... Sorry, it's going on its own. No, sorry. Yeah, with all the buzz, lots of companies and applications are moving to... it's moving on its own, playing on its own. Sorry about that. And all these cloud applications have different requirements, and these place different demands on the underlying storage system, like availability, consistency requirements, performance optimization requirements for reads versus writes, or random versus sequential access, and more like low latency requirements or higher bandwidth requirements, and so on. And based on these requirements, there are so many storage systems that have been proposed. But most of the storage systems are quite sophisticated. And oftentimes, an application might not need all the sophistication that these provide, or an application might require features provided by these systems, by multiple systems, probably not all the sophistication, but with some features. The problem is that if you use a storage system for every requirement of yours, you're going to use a lot of resources. And with the cloud computing pay-as-you-go model, you would end up paying a lot more than what you probably otherwise need to. So what we did was we did a simple benchmarking on the cloud on an Amazon EC2 8 node cluster. We just dealt with 10 gigs of data. We wrote the data onto HDFS and HBase, and probably did a MapReduce job. In this case, it's word count. And we see that if it's only HDFS write, it's about 2 gigs of memory usage. If it is HBase, it's close to 5 gigs, and that's a huge difference there. And we see that, for example, in we were working on MapReduce semantics, and we find that in order to get optimistic parallelism and stuff like that, it might be a good idea to share data across jobs or within the same job. And for that, we need a key-value store, but using something like HBase for that would mean quite a lot of resource usage. So we think that it's important to enumerate the different basic requirements that go into a cloud. For example, both web applications and batch-oriented jobs normally use a key-value store or key-value access, and it might be a good idea to have the key-value access in the basic storage system that's available on the cloud, probably a file system. So we think we need to enumerate all these features and incorporate it into the storage system. Probably we can call it a file system or something else. We in this work, we try to incorporate key-value access into the file system. For that, we quite intuitively, as it's done in many key-value stores, index the data for efficient random reads. We store the updates at the end of the file in a log-structured manner for efficient writes. One can use multi-version concurrency control. We haven't implemented yet, but multi-version concurrency control for log-free reads and optimistic concurrency for writing data. And all the serving of this data, the daemons, can be pushed into the file system itself. And we propose a file format and an associated architecture to serve these. The file format is essentially have data blocks of data. Each data block would have records which are sorted on the key. Right now, we are using the key from the key-value pair, but probably the sorting or putting data into blocks can take into consideration other parameters like read-write accesses. Probably something that's accessed more often can be replicated more for higher availability and stuff like that. And then we have a data index that stores what data is in what data block. So reads would just be look up the index, scan through the corresponding data block, and give and return the value. Writes would be create a new data block and write it at the end, append it to the end of the file. This would mean that soon we would have a lot of small data blocks, increasing the data index size, which is not so good for lookup. And that's why what we do is we compact, just like in Bigtable. We compact, but we define a compaction threshold depending on the skewedness of the data storage in the file. The architecture is very similar to GFS. In GFS, you can just the master would give you a replica and you talk to the replica. Here in this case, we want to allow concurrent writes, and for that, we thought it's imperative that we have a primary handler. So we define a primary handler for a WAF file. And every KV file access would First of all, we go to the master, get the primary handler, and then we talk to the primary handler. The writes go to the primary handler and are serialized on the primary handler from various lines. We aim to get a performance for sequential access better than the big table or any key value store, and random access performance better than the file systems. So we see that we are pretty much fine on the sequential file front here for sequential accesses. In HBase, we get an order of magnitude performance benefits on sequential access, and we are off by about 20% on the random access, and we are working on that. We are yet to do a detailed evaluation with compaction and stuff. We are working on the implementations and testing, and hopefully we'll be there soon there. So thank you. Questions?
Great. Next, we have Crystal Curtis from UC Berkeley, determining SLO violations at compile time.
Hi. So my name is Crystal, and I'd like to talk to you about some work I've done with my fellow grad students and our great professors in the Rad Lab at Berkeley. So the setting we're looking at here is the landscape of interactive web apps is very competitive. So if a web app is actually going to make it and be impactful, they've got to meet their service level objectives, their SLOs. But it's also got to be an interesting app that people actually want to use. So developers may find themselves in this tension between, on the one hand, they want to imbue their app with great functionality, but sometimes that results in a hit to performance. So some of the questions that developers are asking as they're coding their apps are some of these. So reasoning about the SLO, will the query's latency be within that? They might also think about, we have cloud computing available. Can we reduce our latency by requesting more machines? And how much would the latency actually be reduced? Also, they're always wanting to add new features. And of course, you want to have an idea of how that will impact the app that you already have. So we'd like to have a way to assist developers as they're asking these questions. So also the setting we're looking at is so many apps today are, instead of using a traditional database as the backend, they're willing to sometimes trade off the strong consistency for other aspects of scalability. And so here are a few examples. SCADS is a project that we're working on in the Rad Lab, so which allows these consistency trade-offs. So in particular, my colleague Michael Armbrust is working on this project Pickle, which is a query language that's approximate to a subset of SQL. A paper that he's written about it will appear in the SOC conference this year. So the cool thing is that Pickle queries map down to query operators, which then some of which have these key value primitives that are involved in executing those operators. And key value primitives are pretty transparent, and we can discern their performance pretty well. So just to walk through the approach with this graphic. So this is a representation of a Pickle query. And so sort and single get are two of the query operators involved in this query. So what we're going to do is we're going to estimate the latency of each of these operators. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to have this distribution of its latency that we've taken from observations of the query's execution in the past. And we'll just take a sample from that histogram, where sampling from a histogram is just like rolling a weighted die, and the heights of those bars are the weights of the dies. And we'll do that for the other operators in the query as well. So once we have estimates for all the operators in the query, we'll combine those, and that gives us a single estimate for that entire query's latency. And so we'll do that many times until we actually get a distribution for the query's latency. Now we can compute the 99th percentile and compare that to the developer's SLO. So we can give them feedback, yes, you're within your SLO, or no, you're over it, and you'll have to allocate more machines or change your query. And we can do this at compile time because we have these models before, as the developer is writing their app, and we have the query plan that's provided by the Pickle compiler. So this is cool to work on a query we've seen, but What we're hoping to do is actually for a different query that we haven't seen before, observing that it's just made out up of the operators that we have seen before. We're going to combine those according to that query plan and produce an estimate for that query's latency, and again, get a 99th percentile there. So just to go into some of the details here, actually combining those latency estimates is the easy part. We have the PICL query plan during compile time, and that tells us how to combine them. The hard part here is getting models that are actually applicable across queries and across diverse load conditions. So the load and the data that's actually being processed by these operators are all kind of captured in that model, and we want to see how complicated do we have to make those models to make good estimates of the query latency. So far, here's a teaser. It's working pretty well for queries I've seen before, so still need to investigate how that can scale to queries I haven't seen. So yeah, please come to my poster, and in particular, I'd be interested to hear feedback about what other questions might developers want to get feedback on at compile time. So thank you.
Great. Next, we have Craig Soles and LazyBase.
Great. So let me just get into this. So what are we looking at here? So we're trying to do enterprise information management. And what that means in a nutshell is all of the laptops, desktops, email, web servers, et cetera, that are sitting in your enterprise, we want to run analysis tools on these files, collect their metadata, and stuff it all into one giant database. And once we do that, then we can do neat things like we can cluster the data, classify it, search it, et cetera. All right, so when you're doing that, as you might imagine, there's lots and lots of data in the enterprise, and because people are constantly doing work, in theory, then there are lots and lots and lots of updates. And we also don't want all these updates to be affecting the queries. We want people to run these queries, you know, at a reasonable rate without having the fact that we're doing lots and lots of updates to affect it. And so at some point, the system will fall over, except that we have one silver bullet, which is that a lot of these applications, like IT trending, intranet search, et cetera, can operate on stale data. So it's okay for the data results to be a day or two out of date potentially, which gives us a lot of leeway in terms of how we can handle all these updates. So like any good systems developer, we take some of the existing solutions that are out there and apply it to our problem. So batching and pipelining to get update throughput. And we run the queries on isolated nodes that gives us the query isolation that we're interested in. And what we do is we have applications specify their required result freshness. And so what this means is that if I'm an application like web search that can be a day out of date, I say, you know, here's the freshness I'm willing to tolerate. Give me results as quickly as you can with that kind of thing. So this is a pictorial example of our system. And on the left-hand side, you've got the millions of laptops that we're going to be ingesting from. And the idea is that as data goes into the system, it becomes durable and then is slowly refined over time to become more and more searchable. So, you know, we map it into the global namespace, we sort the data, that makes it more searchable, we merge the data, that makes it faster to run queries, and so forth. And when people issue queries, they can look at the most stale piece of data, which could be a day or two out of date, and that gives them an answer almost immediately, or they can reach back into these earlier stages and pay some additional cost in order to run their queries on more recent data that's pushed into the system. Okay, so we've built this system at this point. And so the question is, what's the work in progress? Well, it turns out there's a lot of work in progress. And one of the big questions is about freshness. So how do applications specify their freshness requirements? Do they specify it in time? Do they specify it in number of files they're willing to look at, the number of machines they're willing to look at, network latency? How do we convert freshness to an actual query? So if I say things need to be a day out of date at most, where do I look for that stuff? What are the trade-offs between ingest and query performance? So if I start running queries on these, you know, intermediate stages, suddenly they have an effect on the ingest update throughput, and vice versa. If I'm pushing lots and lots of data through the system, my queries might take even longer. So there's a trade-off there, and we need to be able to measure that. How do we optimize the system for a given set of update and query requirements? So if I have 8 machines, where should I be allocating them? Should I have 7 sort nodes and, you know, 1 ingest node? Should I have 3 ingest nodes and 4 sort nodes? It's not really clear. And having models and understanding how to do that is a big open question. There's lots of other work in progress that we can consider. Consistency, distribution. So, you know, most people can't afford to buy as many computers as Google has purchased. And so if you really want to do this with fewer computers, how do you take advantage of the thousands of laptops that might be out there? Personalization, privacy, and security. So how do we maintain privacy of the data that we're collecting from all these laptops and still provide the kind of functionality that I'm talking about? So we're looking for interns. So if you're interested in any of these topics, or if you have questions about anything I've said, or if I've piqued your interest in any way, please come talk to me at the poster session, or you can contact us on our email. So thank you.
And next we have Chris Douglas with GridMix 3.
My name is Chris Douglas. I'm from Yahoo, and I'm here to present a benchmark that I've written in collaboration with Hong Tang, that we use to evaluate Apache Hadoop. Sounds like most everyone here is familiar with Apache Hadoop, but it hosts a number of projects related to distributed computing. The salient ones we're talking about today are the HDFS and MapReduce, which, again, it sounds like everyone's familiar with, so I'm not going to spend any time on that. So one of the things we want in performance engineering especially is a model of production load. And we want this for a number of reasons. Mostly that the saturating loads that we get to test the limits of the system don't necessarily let us predict what particular improvements that we make will have in production load. And so what we'd like to be able to do is take conditions that we've observed in production, either bottlenecks in performance or bugs related to load, and reproduce them in a controlled environment where we can then establish development priorities and be able to see the effect of our changes, again, in that controlled environment and predict what effect they're going to have when we try to deploy them into production, or also to verify that we've fixed whatever problems appear there. So there are a number of challenges to building this sort of synthetic load. We deploy Hadoop on well over 25,000 machines. Each cluster is usually about 4,000 nodes. They're usually pretty heavily loaded, so we can't really mirror production and try things out. So we really do need something that's synthetic and something that we can run over and over again and reproduce when we need to. Also, as I'll get to in the later slides, we have a wide variety of types of different jobs. Each job has lots of different, we'll get to that. And the other part is that our users will modify their behavior. We can't really have a static definition of our load because the users are going to not only adapt to their changing requirements and things like that, but they're also, as we found, will adapt to resource scarcity in the particular cluster that they happen to be running. So we want to stay up to date with that. We want to adapt to that and keep our benchmark current. So this is a snapshot of one of our clusters. I'd like to emphasize this is a logarithmic scale. And so we have a lot of jobs that actually don't process a whole lot of data. Hadoop is built to process petabytes, but a lot of people don't. And so we need to accommodate everything in this spectrum in order to reliably predict what effects our changes are going to have, because the jobs at the tail end up there, the ones that will take the entire cluster if you let them, will affect the performance of the remaining 95% of the users on the cluster. So we need to cover this entire spectrum in our benchmark. So we do that. We do that by taking the particular characteristics of the job and building some sort of synthetic representation of them. And we do that by reading as much as it read from the distributed file system, writing as much as it wrote in as large chunks as it did, and consuming the amount of memory that it took, and hopefully in doing that get a decent model of that particular mix of jobs in that cluster and be able to say interesting things about them. So the cycle that we're generally following is Yahoo users put some load onto our production clusters that will generate some set of artifacts in the job history, job logs, things like that. And we want to distill that down into a digest that will drive the GridMix benchmark to put load on this test cluster, which we can then observe, figure out what's happening. And the digest, by the way, we will be anonymizing and making available. And then once we have validated fixes or development or whatever, we push to Hadoop or the production cluster as appropriate. And actually here I think I'll stop for questions if there are any. Thank you.
All right, great. So our last presentation, but certainly not the least one, is Mingju Li with the case for a new sequential prefetching technique.
Hi, I'm Mingju Li from the University of New Hampshire. I'm going to talk about the case for sequential prefetching technique. Sequential prefetching is a simple but effective mechanism in which contiguous data blocks are read into cache before they are requested. It is very commonly used in storage caches for two reasons. First, file systems try to save data contiguously on disks, and therefore data are usually often read sequentially from the disks. Sequential prefetching, the second reason is more an advanced prefetching technique is not suitable for storage system because they require high-level information from application programs or file systems, which is not available in storage systems. Sequential prefetching is not free like caching because you have to get the data from the disks and put into caches. So the system have to pay some costs. The main prefetching costs include extra traffic on the system and the cache pollution, and the causes of prefetching costs include useless prefetches and early pre-eviction. So the benefits obvious, they can lower the mean response time if the data can be served from the cache. And it can also reduce the system traffic if the prefetch request can combine with the on-demand request. So it will be one single request and send it to disks, which is called piggyback prefetching. So we need to balance the costs and the benefits so that the technique can work more efficiently for the system. The current sequential prefetching techniques include always prefetch, in which prefetch is triggered by every cache access, prefetch on hit, in which prefetch is triggered by cache hit, and prefetch on miss, in which prefetch is triggered by cache miss. This table shows the comparison of costs and benefits of these three techniques. And so it includes the useless prefetches, cache pollution, hit ratio, and the system traffic. The green color means the technique either has a lower cost or higher benefits than other techniques. So it seems like from this table, POH is the best technique in terms of the cost and the benefits. However, when we look at this example, which shows the hit ratio and the response time comparison of these three techniques, we also add the never prefetch as base comparison. Prefetch is not the best in either case. Instead, always prefetch has the highest hit ratio, and POH prefetch on miss has the best response time with this particular workload. So obviously, each technique has their own advantages and disadvantages. So therefore, there's a need for a new sequential technique that can combine the advantages of all the sequential all the techniques and avoid their disadvantages. So the new technique should have the following features. They should detect the sequential pattern and adjust the prefetching degree, and can reduce the system traffic and it use the cache space efficiently. So we propose a new sequential technique that will have a particular prefetch cache which only keeps the prefetch data and the and use the minimum cache space. And we also will have a table data structure so that the they can record the request address for sequential detection. It can remember the hits for prefetching degree and trigger the prefetch. And they also have, they will also have a detection, the function of detecting the deficiency of the cache space. And they will also have a function that can detect the system load. So when the load is high, only piggyback prefetching is allowed to reduce the system traffic. So far we are working on the design details of the technique, and hopefully we can evaluate it and be available to the systems. So for details, please contact us, and thank you.
So great, so that's the works in progress for today. Let's just do one more round of applause.